On today's episode of Boyd Biomedical Design Stories, we're joined by Dr. Michael Chu and John Bonham Carter from Irby Biosystems. We'll be discussing Irby Biosystems' approach to innovation, advanced manufacturing, and building a growing workforce. And I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Johnson, president of MassMedic.
Here's a bit about our guests. Dr. Michael Chu is the president of Irby Biosystems. Prior to joining Irby, Michael cut his teeth at Teradyne and was later involved in several successful startups. John Bonham Carter is the vice president of business development and product management at Irby. He has 25 years of experience in the bioprocessing field.
Michael and John, welcome. It's great to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, man.
I'd like to start with a discussion about the biotech industry as a whole, cell and gene therapy, where the industry is going. John, can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So Irby's in the cell therapy process development and manufacturing industry. This is the industry which is going to be changing dramatically over the next 10 to 20 years. Today, it's personalized manufacture for a very small number of patients in the thousands for less than a dozen therapies, and they're all super expensive because of supply chain issues. And the fact that these are patients' own cells that are being flown to a location, manipulated, and flown back. And this is not supportable in the future. And so Irby's goal is to change how people do that manufacturing.
And can you just give a little context to where we're coming from in terms of cell therapies and the fact that that kind of personalized, smaller scale manufacturing is not really the historic context of the last couple decades for biomanufacturing?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, go back to the early 80s when Genentech and Amgen were making their drugs. You know, it was the cells were doing recombinant proteins and getting antibodies out. And this was the early days of biotech. That started in roller bottles and flasks, just like cell therapies today. But they quickly realized over the next 10 to 20 years, they built these huge centralized facilities, big sort of stainless steel dinosaurs, they can be called now. But they were very good at manufacturing antibodies at low cost and then distributing them globally. So in cell therapy, the change is now you're using your own patient cells. You can't put them in these centralized facilities without all of those logistics problems. So the goal will be to say, can we make distributed manufacturing closer to the patient? And the problem with that is when you put robots and automation in there, if the process is still inefficient, a bit like the roller bottles of EPO and Amgen in the early days, you can automate those roller bottles, but in the end, it's still an inefficient process, which has high costs. So you need to change the whole way of doing processing and make a highly intensified, very small footprint, efficient process, which has very few touch points for humans. But you can have multiple people cells in a room, 50 people in a room rather than one, those cells. And then that can be close to the patient, so shortening the time when the patients are in their most diseased state, unfortunately.
About how long is the current process to do this?
So it can be as much as 3 to 4 weeks, and people are now trying to get it down to a week or two. And each of these days when the cells are out of the human person, you know, these are typically stage 4 and later patients, so every day matters. And I guess that's one of the issues in cell therapy at the moment. When you finish that therapy, if it didn't go quite right, you're still really injecting to a large degree that therapy back to the patient because they're about to die. And the real goal of cell therapy should be to expand access to everyone with that indication much earlier before they've exhausted all other therapies. And that requires this cost change that we're speaking about.
That's really what, Michael, you're... technology is bringing to the market, right? This is dose scale closed system that is going to help cell and gene therapy take off, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the model that John described of having some, you know, large centralized facility with maybe dozens of PhDs running around making individual therapies just won't scale, right? If we're going to get beyond, you know, a few hundred, few thousand doses per year, it has to be much more automated, much more controlled. And you know, truthfully, having humans involved in the process is only inviting some error or mischief. And so you have to really think about how do you build a manufacturing ecosystem that is patient-centered and is able to produce, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of individual doses for individual patients. And that's really what our technology does.
Do we have the infrastructure for this? I mean, when you think about Boston, we're in Boston, you know, we have this center of innovation in biotechnology. Is the, you know, everything from the facilities to the people, I mean, is it even just beyond Boston, you know, nationally, is it here?
I think the answer is no, and everybody realizes that. You know, getting a cell therapy is sort of like waiting for a liver transplant, right? They're very scarce and hard to get, and that's really the problem we're trying to solve, right? So rather than, you know, building out these large, you know, patient isolated clean rooms where each patient's, you know, gets their own little, you know, manufacturing facility, maybe the size of this office. Irby's vision is to have that manufacturing platform be the scale of a small desktop machine. And that will allow you to put, you know, hundreds of these machines in one manufacturing suite. And then, you know, you're really not limited to having a big centralized facility. You could imagine putting these at a regional center, maybe even in the basement of the hospital where the patient's being treated.
Sounds a little analogous to an apheresis machine or a dialysis machine, things like that. Is that sort of analogous to what you guys are working on?
Yeah, that is a good analogy. The process typically starts with apheresis, and it happens to be a much longer and more complex process than apheresis. And the real trick there is to fully automate the process. Sort of the term of art is, you know, vein to vein or needle to needle processing. You want to take the cells from the patient, put them into your machine, your process, and then let it run, and don't let, you know, humans get involved where they can contaminate or maybe cross-contaminate with another patient or maybe lose track of data. You want to really know that what you get out is exactly what you expected when you started. And that's really the holy grail of cell therapy manufacturing.
Michael, I wanted to ask about investors and funding, you know, this venture. We hear a lot about manufacturing technologies really not being something that, you know, certainly the venture community is not interested in funding. And then you hear about funding in the biotech industry at large. I think this is not what people think about. We're talking about a process technology, a manufacturing technology. Can you talk about attracting and bringing your investors along to what you're doing?
Well, you're right. It's a little bit of a blind spot for the industry, right? It's easy to invest in sort of the sexy therapy. It's a little bit less interesting to you know, fund the picks and axes to you know, dig the gold out. So we've been very fortunate. You know, we started in this industry in intensified process development. Antibodies, and so we have an existing product. We have an existing product that works. Customers are buying it, and it's really well suited for cell therapy. So we came from a place of strength and operating performance, and now as we engage the cell therapy market, we can deliver results right away. And so that has, you know, back to your investor question, that's a much more compelling, much lower risk approach for investors. So they're quite comfortable with our existing business, and they are really excited about the potential in cell therapy, both process development and ultimate manufacturing.
Can we talk a little bit about sort of the arms race you guys are kind of competing in? I mean, like a little bigger picture of the market, where you guys, what's sort of the holy grail here in terms of what race you're competing in? What do you need?
I think at the moment, the cell therapy is right at the beginning of its growth, right? Even though CAR T, for example, has been around many years, and the first CAR T patient is still alive today. I think this is right at the beginning of a hockey stick. And naturally, therefore, there's lots of people piling in with all sorts of different technologies. But to a large degree, they're all relatively inefficient processes that are trying to be automated. And so I think the eventual winners in this race are obviously going to have products which are easy to use, which deliver on all the cost benefits we've spoken about, and make it easy to access. But I think there's going to be a range of different products, because there is leukemias and there's solid cancers, and each of these types of therapies will require slightly different processing.
So what you're describing is, or at least what I'm imagining, is a competitive environment that has a lot more companies versus this sort of blockbuster drug sort of phase we've been in for 20 or 30 years, or do I have that wrong? Are they just going to have bigger product portfolios that cover various sort of therapies?
So I anticipate that every new modality comes along, you add in a layer of complexity to the biotech industry, which requires new tools. And so we're not getting rid of the old tools. Still, people are taking the existing cancer treatments made in these huge centralized facilities. But you're adding on a new set of tools. Both those are the manufacturing pieces, but also the process development, which basically doesn't really happen in cell therapy today. There's very little process development, very little monitoring, very little improvement in that process because people are trying to do it so quickly, they don't invest the time and the money, and the tools don't exist. So we view ourselves as inventing the tool to say, finally, you can do proper process development, like you know you want to, and you can transfer that to manufacturing. And so we're adding on a whole range of tools that will be bolted on for these types of personalized therapies.
And to build on that, you know, ultimately, as John said, there's two challenges in this industry, right? To get to, you know, a large enough scale so that we can service all customers, we can cure all customers, we need both the manufacturing capacity that we talked about, but we need really well-structured processes, well-understood processes, so that we can confidently make those doses. We don't want to make doses just for the stage 4 end stage cancer patients. We want to make doses for the phase 2 patients, right? And make sure and have confidence that the therapy that we've manufactured is going to improve their outcome, extend their life, and not put them at risk. And so that gets to the process development aspect that John mentioned. One of the big challenges you have in these personalized medicines is you don't have a lot of material to do process development. Imagine if you're creating a biologic drug, you take some immortalized cell line and you make run thousands and thousands of experiments. And you know those experiments are informative because you're starting with the exact same starting material. In cell therapy, it's very different because you might get, you know, enough material from a donor to run 5 experiments if you're lucky. And you get whatever results you get and you look at them and you draw some conclusion and you say, well, I want to run 5 more experiments. So what do? You go get another donor, a different donor, and you get 5 different results. Now, are the differences due to changes in your process, due to differences in donors, just due to random variation? You really don't know. And when you take that process and then translate it over to the actual patient, the patient cells are, of course, going to behave differently than the donor cells because the patients are very sick. The donors are not. And so this limitation, this non-availability of starting material to do process development is a really critical issue for this industry, and it limits your ability to develop high-performing processes. So think back to what some of the others in the industry are doing. They're taking existing processes and existing tools and automating them. They're running them faster. Maybe they're getting rid of human errors and getting rid of contamination. But the core process is still the same. And so those tools will be challenged in doing process optimization. And so what you really need is you need a tool that allows you to run many, many more experiments on the PD side. And then once you've really tuned your process, have a very simple translation to manufacturing scale. And that's really what our technology does. It's a PD tool that runs at dose scale runs a small enough scale so that you can run dozens of experiments from a single donor or patient.
Is there any other solution to the starting material issue of, you know, being able to have more capacity to develop process? I mean, what I'm envisioning in my head is that the bioprocessing process is developed by replicating what happens in a lab, right? I mean, and so you're limited to an extent of, you're saying that, you know, that you don't have enough material to go through these experiments, but is there any solution to that, to be able to bring more process technology into the market prior to, you know, a new potential modality being there and you're looking at it saying, how do we replicate what just happened?
This is tough. So today when you get cells from a donor and you want to run a vast number of experiments to say which is the best conditions, which is the most optimum window to operate in for my manufacturing. Today, if you want to run lots of experiments, you have to run very, very basic experiments in open flasks and a biosafety hood, right? And so using very small amounts of cells to look at sort of global conditions. But those are often unmonitored and experience the variability that you would in any biological process. So you really want an environment where you're controlling everything about the cells so that when you repeat that experiment again, you know you've got it under control. And this is the fundamental point about a well-instrumented machine and a kind of what I'll just bluntly call an open flask, right? An open flask is the state of the day today. And we make instrumented, automated, industrialized bioreactors with all sorts of other features, but which still are at that very, very small scale, so you can get a significantly huge amount of information out of it before moving on to saying, what is my optimum process and moving it across.
So, gentlemen, you know, this is fascinating stuff. I'm trying to think about sort of the end of the innovation journey. Are we talking about a bedside lab, or are we talking about sort of a new part of the hospital where these are done off-site? But maybe it was my distinction with the dialysis machine, but I sort of said to myself, oh, is this a lab right next to the patient happening in real time?
It's a nice thought. I don't know if bedside is quite the way that I imagine it. You know, there is a push to move everything much closer to the point of care, right? And there's lots of reasons for that. Many of them are just logistics, right? The time it takes to freeze and transport and unfreeze these cells is all time that is you know that the patient doesn't have necessarily. Of course, as these therapies become more available, they'll be going to patients who are perhaps less sick and perhaps have a bit more time. But the there's really no value in those logistics, right? Other than being able to have a centralized facility. So to the extent you can move this technology, and we think we can, you know, I'll say next to the patient, I think there's value, but it doesn't need to be on the bedside. It needs to be, you know, maybe in the basement of the hospital or a regional center where you can have an Uber take the cells over to get processed. But it's really getting as close to the point of care as possible to eliminate the logistics.
One of the key steps at the end of a cell therapy is a quality check, right? So you've taken the cells out, you've manipulated the cells. You need to prove before the cells go back into the patient that you haven't introduced any adventitious agents, any virus or bacteria. So there is a series of QC steps which take a number of days. And so if it's something by the bedside, then there's no gain. The patient's still walking out of the hospital, or maybe staying in the hospital, depending on their condition. I think if you were to look, you know, 10 years, I think that's still true. If you look 20, 30 years in the future, 30 years ago, we didn't have mobile phones, really, did we? So I think 30 years in the future is a very long time. And if you can solve that quality check, that safety check quicker, I think, you know, this is a process where you might stay for a day or two in the hospital and achieve it. I think lots has to change by then, but I think technologically it's possible. The Erbitech itself is absolutely capable with its microfluidics of delivering everything you need to manipulate those cells. So I think we're positioned for it. It's definitely not our current product today, but I see no reason why it wouldn't be our, you know, our product of a decade or two away.
Wow. I just wanted to follow up on the quality piece. You mentioned the QC check. I mean, what's your impression of the regulatory environment sort of keeping pace with innovation, you know, as it relates to this aspect of the business?
This is tough. I mean, we're dealing with increasingly complicated therapies where underlying it, we have a reasonable understanding of the mechanisms, but not a full understanding of actually everything you're injecting back into the patient. So when you take out a population of cells, you think it's a number of cells, but of course it's millions and billions of cells, each of which has got its own subpopulations. You then manipulate them, you modify them, and you're injecting back a population of cells. So in the end, at the moment, the choice is, do you treat this patient, given the limited knowledge you have, but a but a likely chance of success, or do you not? And today, the FDA more or less says, these patients are going to die. You should probably inject it. In fact, that one of the very first patients, the QC check failed, and they still injected, and they survived, right? And so this is right at the beginning. And so in our case, what we look at this, what do we bring to the table? We say, well, we don't know what happened there, but I do want to run that process identically again for the next patient. And that's tough to do today, if not impossible. And that's what we're going to bring. But that quality check is key, and it's badly understood, unfortunately, today.
This is maybe a oversimplification, but it's almost like where we currently are is in the personalization, you know, phase, but that we're going to over time move towards the preventative stage, which is what you mentioned, Michael.
Right, it's sort of industrialization, right? Today, it's a little bit bespoke therapies, and you really want to make it so that it's there's no drama in the manufacture. It's just you put the cells in, you run them, and you're confident that they're going to work.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to take a look at the tour we took of your headquarters in Sonoma, Mass. A couple weeks ago. And then on the other side of that, we'll be back to talk more.
Boyd Technologies is an advanced materials and technology company operating in the medical device and life sciences market. We're experts in regulated single-use devices and liquid media solutions. Our growth platform provides a full suite of services for design and development, advanced manufacturing, and fulfillment operations. To learn more, visit us at boydtech.com.
Welcome to Irby Biosystems here in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Michael, thanks so much for having us today. I'm really excited to take a tour.
Thanks for visiting Irby. Welcome to our facility.
We're going to take a walk around the facility and check out your engineering and manufacturing capabilities. Before we do that, tell me about the innovation that Irby's bringing into the market.
Yeah, we make small-scale cell culture devices. This one's 2 milliliters. This will be used to develop and manufacture new therapies to address cancer and other diseases.
That's great. Can we go take a look?
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Come on.
You guys have just moved in here about a year ago. Talk to me about sort of where you're going and the scaling of the business right now.
Like you said, we moved in here in April of last year. This is a great upgrade for us, coming out of a garage. And now we're sort of in full scale-up mode, right? We have a product, customers are buying it, and our number one priority is making sure we meet the customer's needs and at a quality that they expect. And that's why we work with partners like Boyd, who can help us on the manufacturing and quality side.
Yeah, I think it's really apparent and great to see when you come through the facility, all of the dimensions of science and technology that you have going on here, software, hardware, and electronics, biology, that is really what you guys are scaling.
Really, our core value proposition is the ability to combine all of these factors, the engineering, the software, the customer's biology, and the application, and deliver a fully integrated, easy to use, high performing product so they can focus on their science rather than our equipment.
I'm excited to go meet some of your engineering team.
Let's go talk to them.
Kyle, it's great to meet you. We're back here in the software engineering part of the business. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do?
So yeah, I've been here about 3.5 years, and my role has changed quite a bit over that time. So I started out as an intern, and I was working a lot on more of our product development stuff. So I was doing development of our CO2 box, so things like prototyping, writing our software and firmware for it. And then that transitioned into doing our manufacturing testing suite and automating all the tests back there. So I did about 10 different automated tests, different fixtures, programs and stuff for that. And now I focus mostly on our next generation of our software platform.
you guys are doing all your firmware and your software platform that your clients are using all here internally at Irby, right?
That's right. We write everything here.
Yeah, that's really cool. And how do you find the interaction or the sort of team dynamics between, you know, the software engineering group here and the engineers that are dealing with the physical product itself?
So being here so long, I've gotten to kind of see the team grow when it was only five of us to however many we're at now. And so with that, I've gotten to work with a lot of different groups. And so I feel like I get to see a lot of different aspects of the company, and I can develop really good relationships with all the development engineers here.
I know you said you're working on the new software platform. Is that for next gen device? When do you think you guys are gonna bring that into the market?
So we're hoping to roll it out at the end of this year. This would be an extension on our current platform, and then kind of being the first stepping stone into our next generation product.
We're in the ops area now in your production facility. Can you tell me a little bit about the assembly process here and how you guys are putting this product together?
Absolutely. This is our pod right here. It's broken down to all of its components. This is the external support that goes into our bioreactor, provides heat, pressure sensors, and everything that it needs to create an environment that's perfect for growing cells.
Great. And what about you? How long have you been in your role here?
I'm coming up on just about a year now. It's been a crazy change, and it's been an excellent small company life. I mean, you see the growth in real time, and you solve problems in real time, and makes you feel like a part of bigger, something bigger.
And what's your favorite part about the day-to-day in ops?
Day-to-day as a manufacturing engineer is so flexible and versatile. You have to solve so many different types of problems, and first and foremost, helping my techs do their job the best the way they can. That comes in many different ways, so I like working on that day-to-day and working with cutting-edge technology.
That's great. Well, thanks for showing us around.
Thanks so much, Matt.
We're in here in your production facility where you're putting together all of your single-use cassettes. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
The major responsibility that I have here is working in the clean room here. And what we do here is just make the microbioreactor cassettes. What that entails is it's a two-week process that comprised of 12 steps. And that's the consumable aspect of the product offering that we have here at Irby.
So 2 weeks is the entire process for just that one part?
Yeah, just the entire batch. But generally it takes it's usually about 24 cassettes within a batch, so it's generally about 2 weeks.
And what do you like best about your job here?
Here at Irby, I'm able to do sort of like, again, it's a two-week process for cassette fabrication. It's comprised of 12 processes. I do one step, and I won't be doing that step until 2 weeks from now.
Right.
So it's a lack of repetitive view.
Yeah, cool. Very cool. And how long have you been in your role here?
I've been here for almost 2 years now.
Okay. And what were you doing before that?
I was a dental assistant working as assistant to the dentist.
And so far, do you like biotech and Irby?
I definitely enjoy it. I love the autonomy, the whole science aspect and cell culture idea of it.
That's great. Well, it's really great to meet you.
Nice meeting you too, Matt.
Tell us what's going on. We're in your bio lab here. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
So right now we're mid-run, mid-experiment. Typically to set up into getting into the state, it takes about 3 days total to set up the system, characterize the media, and then calibrate the cassettes. After that, we inoculate, put our cells in, and then the experiment runs for about 3 to 4 weeks as the cells grow and we take measurements, whether it's optical density, pH, dissolved oxygen, to make sure the cells are growing accordingly and they're fed with the media and glucose.
So tell me about your role here at Irby.
I am the junior field applications engineer, and with that I have two aspects to my role. I'm both customer facing and doing some things in-house. So for customer facing, I'm either training customers or conducting demos, and these are typically done in person. During COVID, we had some virtual runs, but when I'm going to these customer sites, it's for those same 3 days to go through setup all the way through inoculation, putting in the cells, and then monitoring the run for the next 3 to 4 weeks with the customers. So I'm the primary technical interface for the customer during those demos and post-sales So basically, I just need to make sure that the customer is getting what they need out of their demo, their collaboration, or their newly purchased system, and growing their sales on target and making sure they understand how to actually use the system.
So this is sales, but very technical. Can you, what's your background? How did you come into this role?
Fresh out of college, May, just graduated with a biomedical engineering degree. I was more in the medical device sphere, and I had a coworker who actually started working at this company, Kyle. He recommended me for this position as I love talking to people, had the engineering background, and I love ever-changing everyday activities, which is literally this job. So that's how I ended up here, and I'm really excited and can't complain.
Yeah, so kind of the perfect fit for you. Do you think biotech is going to be it for you? I mean, is this the career path?
Definitely, yeah. I've always had an interest in the technologies and sciences. My mom is an environmental engineer, and while I liked her role, I knew bio was for me, but I still wanted to stay within engineering and just tech itself. So being at the front facing of all these amazing technologies, like, I really love it.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Kevin, it's such a pleasure to be here today and tour Urby and see all of the facility. You're a co-founder of this business. Can you tell me a little bit about the science and the founding behind Urby?
Yeah, so this is actually a project that's been going on for quite a long time. This is PhD work that was started actually by the other co-founder, Harry Lee, a few years before I even started. And the lab originally was doing semiconductor lasers. It wasn't even doing biology. But then they got into projects on sensing and projects that related to doing bioreactors, and all of a sudden transitioned into actually making bioreactors as well. And when I joined the lab, I had a focus on, or I had a desire to work on electrical engineering, but with a focus in biology, and it seemed like a good place to get started. And so when I joined the lab, they had already started going down the path of making bioreactors. That was really cool. So we started doing that. I started doing that in addition to with Harry. And I guess together we built out a lot of core technologies that were needed. He invented most of the actuation and mixing and all the ways to do gas transfer. And I worked on a lot of the fluid design to be able to do the flow correctly, as well as a lot of the manufacturing process that we use today to be able to make the cassettes that we have.
You really feel walking around here even now, which is that there's so much science and technology here you guys have created in the system as a whole, but even today there's components that you're manufacturing here that go into the hardware of the device, building software yourselves. How is that changing as you guys are, you know, clearly moving out of the lab and sort of startup scale? Now you're really in this scale-up mode. You know, how do you see that changing as you go forward?
It was built from the ground up with the two of us originally. We had to do basically everything because there was no help, really. In that time, we managed to make almost everything you see today, but it does take more work than that. Once you start having customers, it takes a lot of manpower and people to do everything that needs to be done. And so there's a lot of hiring people to make things, a lot of hiring to help with R&D and design, and also outsourcing to get people to help make components that just are impractical to make in-house because it just takes a lot of effort and people know how to do it better. And so it has been nice to see that. I mean, at the very beginning, I'm the one in the clean room making the things. I'm also out at the customers helping to set it up. I'm also doing the work to design the next new ones, and it's just too much work, right? And so it's nice to be able to focus more on the things that each individual person cares more about versus having to do everything.
What is that for you going forward? Is that the science, the R&D?
Both of us are still here. Harry's here, I'm here. He's focusing more on the engineering and the design science. I'm now more transitioning into helping customers and having collaborations. So most of my time now is spent working technically with collaborators, universities, industry, customers, and helping them to develop their applications with our product and understand what is working and what isn't working so we can make it better or make new products that will be better for them. And that's kind of one of the main reasons why we're sitting here we are now in this bio lab, is because it's almost impossible to do everything we need to do at the customer sites. We actually bring all of it in-house to be able to build out the applications first and teach them. We also have a drive to better our understanding of the science and the biology so that we can make better products ourselves that will help them, even if they don't know it yet. So it's a good environment to be able to answer those questions.
This must be an incredibly proud moment for you to see this innovation, series of innovations, this idea starting to really scale in the marketplace.
For me personally, the drive has always been to make the tool for the people, but also learn and gain knowledge on what is happening in science and in the biology to better my understanding of what needs to be made and what needs to happen.
And what do you see as the biggest impact or most exciting thing in terms of how this is going to impact patients?
In an ideal world, this would be the tool used to make the therapy that's going into the patients, right? That would be awesome. For me, it's really right now these CAR T cancer therapies are just so expensive, they're so labor intensive. Any technology, ours or another, that is going to be able to help them bring that down and get the access out to more people would be great. And to have the ability to work on one of those that could potentially be the future tool is great.
Well, it's incredibly inspiring. I appreciate you guys having us today. Thank you very much.
Oh yeah, thanks.
We just had a really great tour around the facility, met people in operations, hardware and software engineering, Michael, the executive team. You guys are scaling and growing. Talk to me a little bit about the challenge, the opportunity that you guys are looking at from a human capital standpoint as you try to scale the business.
You know, 2022 is a huge year of growth for Irby. Back when I started in August of 2021, we've already more than doubled in size. I say we have several positions out right now, at least 10 or 12 positions that we're actively recruiting for. Posted on our website, through Indeed, through LinkedIn, through all these sites, and it's exciting to watch the teams build. All the new employees we're hiring, I just love. And it's just an exciting time right now for us in the HR department.
So talk to me a little bit about the mission-driven purpose of Irby. Does that help, you know, right now? Is that resonating with people to bring them in the recruiting environment?
Some of the reasons why Irby is a great place to work is, number one, our product. The people here are so passionate about our product. They want to see it to the end. They want to see it succeed. And, you know, we're here, where Irby's a small company, but there's so many opportunities for people to gain more professional development. They can build a wider range of experience. They can build on their tasks within their departments as well as outside departments if they like to head in that direction. You have more and more one-on-one times with your managers, more and more one-times with employees. You're not just a face in the crowd like you're at the larger company. Here, everybody knows your name. And we find that very special, you know, and the culture seems to appreciate it. Culture's huge for us.
I think you really see that when you walk around and meet the team here. There are people that have come from other industries.
Mm-hmm.
They're all talking about growth and, you know, expanding their own skill set, the company expanding, you know, scaling and expanding capabilities. There's a very exciting team atmosphere here. If somebody's watching this and they want to, you know, check out the jobs you guys have at Irby, where do they go?
Irby sounds like a company you're interested in. You want to be part of this innovative and exciting team, just go to our careers page on irby-bio.com/careers. And you can always reach out to me as well. And that's Kathy Brown, Kathy with the C, at irby-bio.com.
Great. Thanks so much for having us today. We're going to go back to the studio and continue the interview.
For more than a quarter of a century, MassMedic has been the voice of the groundbreaking medical technology industry in New England, advocating for sound public policy that supports innovation and fostering a community built on a shared purpose, saving and improving the lives of patients everywhere through medical technology. Since the beginnings of New England's dominance in health tech, our members, the women and men who make up MassMedic, are researching, designing, developing, supplying, manufacturing, and deploying the next generation of medical innovations around the globe. The heart of health tech beats here in Massachusetts. And at MassMedic, we're proud to be part of that journey. Learn more about how you can join our community at massmedic.com.
Okay, welcome back. I'd like to dig into a little discussion about manufacturing and a little bit about your workforce. That was a fascinating tour. Thank you. I've been struck by kind of two things, and I want to try to understand how interrelated they are. One is the complexity of your manufacturing and the multidisciplinary nature of it, what you guys are doing in your facility. And the other is the complexity of your product and the relationship it has to the point of care, really. You know, how important is the connectivity, or how does the connectivity work between manufacturing and product development for your company?
So it's a great question, because it's an area we spend a lot of time thinking about. You know, the product fundamentally is built around our microfluidic cassette, or you know, this fluidic system we use for cell processing. And it's not a simple device. There's a lot of kind of innovation and unique structures and fabrication processes built into that. That's where some of our core IP is that came out of MIT, you know, a decade ago. That platform for manufacturing this device, you know, is the basis for, you know, our entire systems engineering of the product. So, you know, like any platform, it has some strengths and some weaknesses, and it allows us to do, you know, to do a number of things. So, for example, our current Breeze product is a 2 milliliter, you know, fully integrated closed system, and our current cassette manufacturing is sort of built around that scale. And we can take that and expand it up to maybe twice the volume. But if we want to go to, you know, 3, 4, 10x the volume, we need to rethink how these things are put together. And so there's really close interaction between the product development and the manufacturing development of our products. It's a lot like, you know, computer chips or cars or things where, you know, you develop a platform and then you build products and derivatives off of that platform. So we got a lot of interesting work going on the next platform, which will enable a few things, which will enable, you know, newer, more exciting capabilities. But our current platform is sort of optimized for what we do, and we've built our manufacturing process, our supply chain, and our quality systems all around our current manufacturing platform, and as well we built our products features around that platform. Just like we have to think about the product development as tied to a manufacturing process, the capabilities of our hardware products are similarly integrated. You know, one of the maybe not so obvious competitive advantages we have is this really tight integration of multiple domains of engineering within a single product, which I think is relatively unique for a biological instrumentation company. You know, we have within our very small Breeze product, we've got electronics, optics, microfluidics, cell processing, you know, mechanics, and software. All of those things are integrated with each other. They have to work in concert in order to get the results that work. Part of the reason for that integration is to make sure that the user experience is very good, simple to use, easy to access. Part of it is to help us retain the small size, because I think there's a lot of value in the small size. And then a lot of it has to do with just performance.
Do you want to speak at all, John, to the kind of future product development, what the enabling technologies you guys see as necessary for, I mean, when you really think out further, other areas of the market that you're hoping will continue to develop?
One of the reasons I joined Irby was because of what Mike's just spoken about, that integration of design, all the different teams working together is fantastic. So I thought, wow, this is the core which takes us a long way down the road. We don't have to bring in outside technologies to do a lot of what we want to do. And that was super attractive. What would we love to do? What are our customers asking us to put in? Well, a lot of it is to do with, I want to know more about what's going on in my process. And we've already added, 5-10 times more than what other people have. But once you give people a taste of what they could have, they want everything, right? And so I think adding in more spectroscopic methods or other methods of analyzing what's going on inside is where people want us to go. And so, you know, although we don't have the skill in that piece, we've got the skill in manipulating the cells, manipulating the liquids on a level that we can deliver microliters to any analysis machine and back again with small modifications to our design. So I think we're going to explore that area with customers in the future. But to a large degree, I think the most innovation is going to be ensuring that it works for all cell types, whether that's, you know, iPSCs, whether it's other types of stem cells, NK cells, beta cells, macrophages, and the T cells where we're most active today. And so I think to some degree, although customers want us to make everything with all this super information and highly detailed, actually I think easy to use, reliable, and repeatable is like the core of everything. And I think that's why we want to keep on innovating. I look at it a bit like Apple. Apple's kind of got everything integrated together. And that's kind of a little bit where we're going, whereas the rest of the industry is more like a PC. It's different pieces, and you have to move information from one bit of the PC to another bit of the PC from a different supplier. That's the same as a lot of our competitors. They've got great individual pieces, but they're moving it across. So looking forwards, I think it's we don't need to innovate as much. We need to adapt our technology.
Does that impact speed to market? I know that's a relative term in this industry, but is the integration of that you just described of your product, ultimately, does it benefit the ability to bring a new drug into the market more efficiently, call it, but more quickly?
I thought you were asking a different question, which is, you know, does our integration slow us down in terms of speed to market? And in that case, I mean, that really depends a lot on how you design your platform. And I guess I'll say, you know, we've been thoughtful on this. We have the ability to quickly iterate on aspects of our design to address a wide range of customer needs. In terms of our customers' speed to market, I think, as I said earlier today, you know, the ability to run high-performance cell cultures at a small scale allows, you know, many more experiments, much faster learning, better processes, all of which will result in faster, you know, time to market for our customers, right? In the end, it's one thing to sort of have an initial encouraging result. It's another thing to be able to develop a process. You can get that result, the same result, over and over and over again. And that's when you have the confidence to bring a product to market.
Switching gears a little bit to supply chain. I think you've already given a lot of good context, which is helpful to understand kind of in the global supply chain crisis that we're in right now, why your technology is really built to be closer to the point of care anyways. So it's to some extent, it's sort of tangent to this issue, but I just want to ask about supply chain because it's such a critical issue right now. You know, is it impacting you from a raw materials and just your own supply chain standpoint? Is it impactful to your sales success in terms of being able to sell a product that maybe mitigates some of these risks?
Great question, especially at this time in our lives, right? In many respects, we've been very lucky and we've also been very thoughtful about this. Early on, you know, I think as many people can relate to, we had problems just getting tubing, right? C-Flex tubing was, you know, a year delivery time. And we learned some important lessons because we really had to scramble. And you know, with the help of our investors, we've essentially, you know, filled our pipeline of materials, of the critical materials that we need. Yeah, there's still an occasional struggle with a computer chip or whatnot that forces us to do some design work. So in that sense, you know, we've done okay, right? We haven't really had any major hiccups there. The other part that we're thoughtful is really understanding where our manufacturing operations add value and where we should find a good partner to do the things that they do well. And I guess I'll give a plug for Boyd. You know, we have a relatively complicated for us assembly with many, many parts that needs, you know, attention to detail and cleanliness. And That's not necessarily our expertise, that the logistics, that manufacturing process. And being able to go out to Boyd or a few of our other critical vendors and trust that they can deliver that without us having to worry about it lets us really focus our efforts on the things that we do well and we can control.
So I mean, there's two points on supply chain I think it's worth mentioning. Because we've got a team which is integrated, which understands every aspect of our product, we've got experts in the room. So when there is a supply chain issue, and Mike mentioned one about a computer chip, you know, discussion moves to, right, let's get a different computer chip, let's reprogram our software so that there's no interruption to the supply. It's not a part the customer sees, we can prove it to the same functionality. That is something that in the biotech industry is relatively unusual. Because so much, particularly on the electronics, is outsourced. They might be experts in the biology, on the plastics, but often on the electronics and the software, it's not in-house. So that would put people in a bind, and it didn't with us, right? That problem got solved. We ended up solving the original supply problem, and now we've got an optional choice, so now we've got two supply chains. So I think that's a really lovely scenario to have experienced and realized the benefits of the way we run the company. The second point about supply chain, I think, is that, you know, it's key that any single point in the supply chain can impact you. And I think that's really important for us to understand. We can look at it today in the baby formula area, where one plant essentially, caused a huge nationwide problem, right? Yeah, that is not unique. That is everywhere in the biotech industry. So these single points of failures are really important to understand. And the ability to build a wider supply chain, I think, is going to be increasingly forced upon the industry.
Do you see that as, I mean, are there critical components, without going into the weeds on sort of each of these, you know, items that just particularly for the United States that need domestic sources of supply that currently don't exist?
I think it is a good policy to source nationally and locally, right? Whether it's due to COVID or whether it's a volcano over Iceland, I think this is a really a lesson learned a while ago. And if I was, living back in my home country of, well, Britain or France or Sweden, depending on what my home country was, I would also try and buy locally, right? I think that's good for the company. I think it's good for the industries of that region to do that. But I think, sometimes it's not possible and sometimes you need to be international. That's not to be afraid of it at all. Preference is to have both and diversify.
Yeah, I think to build on that, I mean, there clearly are some things like computer chips that you don't really have a choice. The supply chains that I worry about are the ones that impact biology and quality, right? So, we have devices that touch biology. So we are very careful about, for example, where we get our plastics, and are they compliant? Are they FDA class 7 certified? And do we have the proper documentation? And so that's an example of where it's a relatively inexpensive part. We can buy in advance in bulk and be assured of our quality going forward. And as well, some of the other biological interfaces, sensors, and so on. We need to be very careful with who we're working with and engage them and make sure that they have the appropriate, quality plans and processes in place. The other piece of this is, because we've designed everything ourselves and we've developed from the ground up, we also have an innate sense of, what what needs to be tested and how we define quality. And so we've built internal in our organization our own quality systems and quality gates so that by the time the product leaves our facility, we're confident that it works.
Wanted to switch gears a little bit to your workforce. It was great walking around and meeting everyone. Incredibly impressive team. Incredibly multidisciplinary, which you've mentioned a couple times. Are there gaps in the skill sets that you guys need? Just in terms of I know the labor pool is challenged in every area right now. But when you think about that, when you think about all of these key disciplines that are being operated inside of your facility, do you have what you need? Or
of course, you could always want more, right? And it is a really tough hiring environment, particularly in the Boston area. But that said, I think we have a very capable core team. Two founders who started the company, 15 years ago are still with us, and you know, great contributors to our success. I would say it's less an issue of hiring the right people or having the capacity. It's more an issue of figuring out how to transition the company from, you know, where we were a few years ago, which is a scrappy startup, focus on, you know, innovation. The way you solve problems is you think hard about it and you come up with a creative solution. And that's a fun place to work. It's a great way to solve certain classes of problems. But we're now a growing, scaling company, and we've got customers who rely on us. And sometimes the most innovative solution isn't as good as really good execution against, you know, something that's good enough. And finding that balance, when do you innovate, when do you execute, is a skill that we're really looking, you know, to bring more into the company.
I'd like to add, because it's not just someone who's got skill, it's also an attitude that we're particularly looking for. A manufacturing head, for example, who comes from the defense industry, you know, brings obviously a level of quality and attention to detail that's critical, but also isn't stuck with the biases maybe of the biological industry. So occasionally comes up with ideas, different ways of doing it that maybe someone who's worked in a biological field wouldn't done. That's not to say they're always good, but it creates a creative mindset with people with different experiences who are open to a conversation about how to solve things in a new way. And that's a really fun place to work.
I'm curious about what makes it tough to find the right talent in your specific circumstances. Is it the complication? I mean, is it the complexity of the job roles? Is it talent pool? Is it sort of time to hire? I mean, can we drill down a little bit on that?
I think there's really two types of hires broadly that I think about it. You know, one is that there are some integrative thinkers or folks who are interested in thinking across organizational boundaries and you know, thinking about the business case along with the technical case and maybe manufacturing. And those people are valuable, and they're hard to find, right? It takes a certain level of experience to sort of understand what the right balance is of you know, high level versus detailed thinking. But when you find them, that they're great, and we've been very fortunate in getting a number of great people with those sorts of skills. But equally important are those who can really dive deep in their domain of expertise. You still want them to be curious. You still want them to be able to look up and kind of see what's happening in other parts of the company. But they also have to be able to quickly synthesize, well, what are the important things that I need to deliver at this point in time, and go off and maybe first confirm with their peers to make sure that this is the direction we're going in. And then have the autonomy and the capability to go off and make progress. And you know, I'd much rather have someone who's willing to take some of that risk. Maybe go off in the wrong direction, spin their wheels a little bit, but then come back and learn and do better next time than someone I have to go manage on a detail level.
When you're building from a small company, although we're not so small anymore, those key people in a few years might have a team underneath them. So you need to find that right person, because otherwise you'll slow down in your growth. And I think it can't hurt to have a bigger pool, let's be clear, right? I think Boston is a relatively small area. It would be great to have more people to move to Boston at a fast rate they are. I would hope actually we can build houses a bit quicker too, so the house prices don't keep going up in the way they do. But I think it is got an internet. Boston is such a well-known place for biotech now, and also for electronics and software and also finance. I think it's a lovely mix that is in this area. I think we've got to keep on executing at every level of government and industry to keep it at the top of its game.
Yeah, I'll also add that, you know, as lovely as Boston is, you don't have to be in Boston to work for Irby. It's been quite a transition for us going through COVID and learning to work remotely. But I would say on average, you know, people are, you know, 30-40% remote, you know, on average across. We've got, you know, our commercial team is on the West Coast. A portion of our software team lives in Maine. I see them once a month, maybe once a quarter. We're out recruiting for more folks. And really, you know, if you've got that passion to make an impact and passion to work with others and can communicate, you know, it isn't necessary that you live and work in Boston. You can perhaps live elsewhere.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask about culture. You know, as a CEO of a inter-COVID, not post, I don't know where we are in COVID, but, you know, amidst COVID, I mean, how have you managed culture? It seems like really, really well. It seems like a really great culture. You know, how have you managed this kind of new dynamic environment?
It's been a new experience for me. I guess I'm not a boomer, but I'm close enough to one that I've been called that by some of my staff. very early on in COVID, we chose sort of like personal safety over everything, right? And we already have the sort of policy, like vacation policy, is you need a vacation, take one, right? And we trust our employees that they're aligned to the larger mission of the company, and we trust them to make decisions that are fair and appropriate. So early on, we basically said, look, if you don't need to be in the office, don't come in. Right? If you can work from home, work from home. And you know, so the cloud-based tools today are really effective. We all quickly learned how to have online meetings. And a few people didn't come back, meaning they're still working from home. But we've ended up with a pretty good mix. And I'm still not there. Like I want to meet people. I want to see them in person. I want to kind of see they're working. But the reality is, you know, we've already hired great people, right? I trust them. I know they're going to go do good work. They can go do good work from home. If they think they can do good work from the beach, more power to them, right? But I like to say I'm much more interested in the outputs than the inputs, right? Figure out what you need to put into it, but I'll tell you what I need out of it. And that's a good of an approach as I can think of. You know, we're going to continue to evolve. This is a new environment for all of us.
And I think what's interesting is, you know, you might only live 20 minutes away from the office. That doesn't mean you have to come in. So I think the remoteness works for people with flexible needs, family, friends. I mean, maybe it's a trip to the beach, but I think that flexibility is more important now for people to have control of their lives than it was before. You would have sacrificed that before if your company goes, well, that's why they're paying me. I have to do my commute. 20 minutes is a short commute, of course, but you know, some people do an hour and a half. And I think now people are going, no, I actually, that's not a sacrifice I'm going to make for the company. So if companies don't adjust to that, they're not going to get a flexible mindset of person coming in. And that's exactly who we're after. The flexible mindset, I think, is key in our industry today.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Great. Thanks for having us. This has been really fun to talk about Urby and our journey over the last few years. And I'll put a plug in if you're looking for an exciting place to work and want to have a real impact on you know, the health of our society going forward, look us up. We're always hiring you know, smart, motivated people.
Thanks. Good luck. We will be eagerly watching your success.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.